Hello and welcome to Platforms and Pitfalls. I'm Rowan.
And I'm Blue.
And we are here to talk about game design. This is the fifth episode looking at how games deal with dominant strategies. And in this case, we're looking less at games that prevent players from using dominant strategies and more at how games sort of meet players in this arrangement. So games that ask players to rise above their dominant strategies as such.
Sometimes it's cool to just let them exist because they're fun. The reason players gravitate towards them is because it's nice to do that. And you don't necessarily want to take a fun part of it out of the game. You just want players to be conscious of when you're doing something like this.
And our first game really focuses on that, like, consciousness of what you're doing and reacting to it. Warning Forever is a 2003 freeware vertical shooter in the old space shooter sense, not in the modern first-person shooter sense, by Hisoka Okubo. The title is a parody of Darius's warning a huge ship approaches and is a boss rush. But unlike other shooting games, it's fundamentally the same boss each time, but every time you defeat it, the subsequent version becomes more powerful based on how you defeated it, whether it be increasing defenses in certain sections of it, adding more weapons to certain parts of it, extending the size of certain parts of it. And so players have to alter their tactics, lest a single portion of it becomes too strong to deal with.
Minor correction, you said Hisoka Okubo, it's Hikosa Okubo.
Oh, Hikosa Okubo, sorry.
Just to be clear, just because we're doing proper crediting and naming and stuff.
Yes.
Which is fine.
Thank you for the correction.
No, it's all good. It's a really interesting game. Genuinely, because it's just freeware and available. If you're interested in game design, it's probably worth a pickup. Like, once you know what's going on with the game, it'll take you like 5 minutes to really appreciate it, and that's it.
And it's so fun to just tinker with what you can force it to make.
Force the game. It's playing the game, and then there's playing the game. So there's playing the game in the shooter sense, and then playing the game in the how do I mess with the evolution.
And what's cool about this almost is that it uses dominant strategies almost as a mechanic. So, you know, you play it the regular shooter way, you'll get one outcome. And as a score chasing game, obviously you actually deliberately play and force it to evolve in certain ways compared to others. But when you first play it, it like often will challenge how you might usually play and ask you to play a shooter in a different way to how you might usually do so.
I will say that going in, I knew it would adapt, but I expressly didn't look up how and what it would do to adapt. So I played it very normal shootery, couldn't pick out the evolution. And this is something that is a thing with adaptive systems like this, with evolutionary systems like this, that try to adapt to the player. They often make very minute changes unless you are very consciously forcing something specific on it. So apart from just being a very great centerpiece topic for a discussion on dominant strategies, it's also a very good example of just how to have small tweaks matter in the long run.
And what's really interesting, actually, is that the game does explicitly tell you what the small tweaks are before every boss fight. Like, you've got a nice little web graph that shows, like, the axes which it can change, and it tells you, like, this is the new web graph for this.
Yeah, it tells you what weapons it's now favoring and stuff like that. But if you actually go in completely blind, not knowing it's an evolutionary shooter, it just looks like a progression of bosses.
And because, like, you know, it's a small game on a small budget, like, oh, they all look like vaguely similar, like they're built of similar constituent parts. That's a really good budget technique. Whereas actually it's so that it can do a lot of cool adaptive things. There are actually sort of set forms it eventually develops into. Like, I think there's about 10 or 12 different versions of the boss, basically, when you get down to it. But you sort of are building out into over the course of several matches.
I think one of the interesting things about this game is what you said before, that if you play the score chasing aspect of the game, there is a meta, which is its own sense of dominant strategy, right?
The dominant strategy is to specifically avoid certain dominant strategies.
Correct. So there's only so much evolution that can happen between every boss. And it's almost, if you think of it as a resource, you want to spend that evolution where it doesn't hinder you being able to play the game effectively. Now, going into a bit of detail, is the core is the pure heart. It's the very center of the boss. And if you kill that, then the rest of it just dies, which makes sense. focusing that down and only focusing that down makes that get stronger. And therefore, effectively, at the end of the day, makes it harder for you to just be able to go, yeah, I'm going to kill it and it's gone. And so some of the strategy is pushing the evolution into parts that doesn't make the core stronger.
So probably my most successful playthrough, I started like really strengthening it from the back. So I went above it, firing down, which in a shooter you don't usually do. Really strengthening that part so that then later when it got harder, I could just fight it from the front more directly without much concern. And that's like a very simple way of doing this sort of thing. But high level play obviously goes a lot further in stretching it out in weird and different ways.
It's just interesting, right? That you can kind of like put this in front of players as a, this is how you won't be able to play because you won't be able to just play it normally. And it doesn't, what I'm trying to get to is that the dominant strategy exists at the end of the day, depending on your goals. So players will get there. I don't know like how else to kind of like phrase that. Players get there.
But we're talking less about a dominant strategy and more about like an optimal strategy.
That's
which
true.
We've discussed
right?
Previously are different things. Like for the general thing, in a shooting game like this, using the aiming is kind of difficult. So most players will naturally gravitate in their first few plays to trying to fight the boss vertically, straight up. The game very quickly counters this, getting into specifics, with extending the front of the boss down until it basically hits the bottom of the screen, meaning that it can trap you on either half of the screen quite easily. So that really forces players to stop trying to tackle it head on, and forcing them to use the aiming systems and such to work around it rather than straight from the front at a side and angle, quite literally. And so that's more how it counters a dominant strategy as opposed to a meta, just a good optimal meta.
Very, very, very fair and valid point. It's meta and dominant strategy versus dominant strategy.
So dominant strategy twice there.
I know.
Did you mean optimal for one of them?
Yeah, meta and optimal strategy versus dominant strategy. Sorry, my brain is not fully booted, I think.
So yeah, this game's quite simple, so I think we've sort of covered the key elements of that. So we're going to go on to a next game that sort of asks players to not adjust the strategy hugely, but just prompts that moment of, should I change something every battle? Super Smash Bros. Ultimate is a crossover fighting game for Switch developed by Sora Limited and Bandai Namco Studios, directed by Masahiro Sakurai and produced by Shinya Saito and Yoshito Higuchi. So Smash Bros. Has a lot of things going on in it, but we're going to talk about the Spirits mode and Spirit Encounters. So if you haven't engaged much with a single player mode, basically you have fairly simple battles with a few extra rules in place, and you can equip your character with a main spirit and some sub-spirits that give your character some stat increases and various boons. They can range from a simple magic attack up to something more elaborate like extra jumps or being invulnerable to lava or something like that. So the system is fairly simple. It has a system of hard counters where you have red, blue, and green spirits, each of which in sort of a rock, paper, scissors triangle gets a bonus if they're fighting the thing that they are stronger than. So it's a really simple system. However, generally, each encounter will have ways in which you can optimize your spirits to essentially opt out of the things that might make that fight particularly difficult. An example of this is control reversal. Many spirit encounters will randomly swap your controls round left to right. You can equip a spirit to remove that. This sort of thing means that every battle, you have to think about your composition of spirits, rather than just running through the whole thing with the same setup.
Oftentimes, players will choose damage early on because if I deal more damage, I can end the fight quicker. It feels better, stuff like that. And
that's
this is
exactly
not
what I did.
This is not an insignificant amount of damage either. This isn't like, I normally hit for 20 and now I hit for 22. This is like, if you build it right, you can double or even possibly triple the amount of damage you are actually putting out. And that's a lot. So
yeah, the boons are so strong that you can't ignore them at the very least. You have to engage with the system if you're going to do this content at all.
Having said that, it is possible to beat most of the spirits even without any spirit of your own. is, depending on your skill level in the game, it may not be as easy, quite hard for me, but I've seen like people on YouTube like make it challenges of like beating a legendary spirit without any spirit backing of your own. It's possible because the rules of Smash still apply. If you can get them off stage and you can, you know, just kill them off the bottom, how strong they are doesn't really matter.
And Smash has a lot of ways to easy gimping. The AI is still Smash Brothers AI, which it's slightly better in this one, as it always improves, but it's still AI, which means it has gaps and abuses.
But that's not the easy road in this one. The easy road is actually given to you in a almost puzzle-sensey way. Like, yeah, this opponent is going to reverse your controls. You have an out. You can just equip the spirit that disables reverse controls. It's possible.
But in doing so, you might have a build that you really like. So I did a lot of the spirit mode stuff basically with sub-spirits that increase magic attack because I was playing Zelda as much as I could because I like playing a Zelda. But every now and then, I would have to de-equip some of these things. Early on in Spirits Mode is also a really good sense of this, because when you don't have spirits for everything, like, I like playing Zelda. She's a magic character. But a lot of the spirits I got early on in my run helped out sword damage and physical damage and things like that. So it was optimal for me to use Marth instead of Zelda, for example. But then eventually you get enough spirits that generally stops being a problem after 5 or 6 hours in, I guess. Maybe that's an overestimation.
It takes a bit of time to amass the spirits to always have an option, but you definitely get there. It's not hard to get there. And it's also kind of fun after you realize that I should be switching spirits around to go, well, what else can I try? Like, what other things? Like, I was encouraged to play characters that I wouldn't normally play because early on, I got some, yeah, same as you, you know, oh, I got some aura increasing spirits. And I'm just like, oh, I guess I can try Lucario.
That's a good point that I hadn't considered, because I don't want to sound like I'm saying I'm brilliant or anything, but I think you and I have fairly different skill levels in this game.
Yes.
yes. And so for me, with characters that I felt very strong with, I would use them, and no matter what spirit optimization I might do, I will just play Zelda better than I will play Mario, no matter what specific Mario boons I might give him. And I think that that is something that comes into play with a system like this. In the DLC, there are special spirits that are more easy to get because you don't have to go through a large map with existing preconditions and such. So I got from the Fire Emblem DLC a very powerful neutral spirit. Neutral spirits are really interesting in this system. They're specifically uninteresting, I guess, because they get rid of the rock, paper, scissors equation. Like, they don't get a bonus, they don't get a debuff, they just exist, which means that there's one spirit at least that you can stop having to change very much. It had 3 slots. So I generally would have this spirit plus 2 slots with like bonuses to magic or what have you. And then the last slot would be, this stage has lava. Let's cancel lava. This stage has reversing controls. Let's cancel those. But that all said, by doing this, I had to even then add in the various counters for each stage. So I'm doing some tinkering with my dominant strategy. And by doing this, I have opted out of the bonuses that I could be getting. Like, I could be about 25% stronger for almost every battle if I did a bit of tinkering in menus and a bit more thinking. So I made a choice to be weaker to keep on this method.
And I think that's the kind of nice thing about the system that we wanted to get to, is that it forces a choice. It at some point makes players think about, do I want to do this? And I really like that it gives you the option of going, nah, I don't want to think about it. And I'll just use neutral for all of the things. That's fine.
I think having soft counters like this is a really good way to just push players into doing certain things. They don't have to engage deeply with it, but you're just nudging them like, what if you tried a bit more on this thing? And this sort of stuff is really valuable for new players, especially. Like, I've been playing Smash more or less for 20 years now, which is a sentence. I've been playing Smash for a long time now, so like, I have experienced a lot of breadth in its systems and how it plays. And so I'm not someone who has to be pushed maybe as much to try lots of different things, whereas Smash in particular has a few things that players might get almost locked into and not shifting away from very much. It's kind of a different topic, but Smash Brothers, many players gravitate towards Kirby very early on with many, many jumps. And they find it difficult to transition to other characters because they're used to the many, many jumps. and they don't know how to recover without that option anymore. Things like the spirit board modes in Smash Brothers Ultimate really get those players to start using other characters in hopes of optimizing what can be some fairly difficult battles, even in the main campaign. For the most part, you'll want to use other bonuses that don't apply to Kirby necessarily, that will push you to expand who you play as, alongside the fact you simply have to unlock characters, although Kirby is the first character you have, so...
It starts you off easy, right?
Like, the four characters you have the option of unlocking the earliest are fairly simple characters in the grand scheme of things.
It's been a bit of distance between now and when I first started playing, but I do get the feeling that the first few spirits do push you in directions other than Kirby. For example, swords are now stronger, and you go and look, Kirby kind of has a sword, but Kirby's not a sword character.
Kirby's not a sword character. He has one move that has a sword-like thing to it.
Yeah, which probably gets buffed by that spirit because Smash is surprisingly consistent like that.
Yes. Smash and its classifications is a fascinating topic that Smash Wiki is a really cool read if you've got the time.
Yeah. But that's basically it, right? That's basically it. It wants to get players to think about what they have, and even at the high end where they have everything, there is still some thought that goes into it. Some amount of challenge that the players can assign themselves based on how kitted out they want to be for that fight. Is that about cover it?
That does about cover it. So our next title is something that you all might be very familiar with. We've talked about it a time or two before.
So, moving on from gentle nudging, we have a bit more of hard push. Slay the Spire is a 2019 deck-building roguelike developed by Megacrit. It is a roguelike wherein you start with a basic deck of 10 cards and you slowly add specific to your character cards / abilities into the deck. You draw them out, you play them, you have to defend and attack in the same turn. And once your decks run out, you shuffle them back in and you draw them again. Very simple concept. Deck builders are not breaking the mold or anything. But I think very few people at the time had ever seen a roguelike deck builder. Where, because every deck builder game changes anyway, it obviously lent itself to roguelikes. But to have this narrative on top of it was something kind of special. Am I crazy?
In the mobile space, there were a few deck building roguelikes before, but like anything in the mobile space, everyone ignored it basically. But Slay the Spire is definitely even compared to vaguely similar forefathers, a very different experience. Many other deck building roguelikes tended to be more like a classic roguelike than Slay the Spire is. And honestly, not as good. Slay the Spire is unique in just how exceedingly polished it was, even from early in its early access period.
Yeah. So although it was released in 2019, it actually had a lot of attention prior to that. A lot of people had been looking at it for a long time because of, I would say, the flavor of it. It had a very specific aesthetic it was going for. And the play loop is, so refined, in my opinion.
Yeah, there's very little downtime. So one of the really compelling things about its structure is that you basically go straight from interesting encounter to interesting encounter. There's very little walking around, which you and I are both not fans of in general. There's very little between stuff that isn't very directly relevant to either your deck or your battling. So over the course, you're building a deck. Characters generally have a few meta builds, right?
There are directions that the game wants to push characters in that it allows a character to push in, I should say. So as an example, just very quickly, the first character that you get in the game is the Ironclad. One of the directions you can push him in is to get a lot of strength and just hit hard. Another direction you can push him in is armor, getting the ability to preserve armor to defend between rounds, because otherwise the amount of defense that you build up just goes away between turns. There's an ability to just keep building armor over and over again to be tanky.
Yeah, and generally, the game doesn't do a lot to hard counter these things. Generally, if you have a good build, it'll get you through most things pretty well, would be fair to say. Up until some of the bosses, particularly around the third tower, right, you were saying?
Spire 3 or... I don't remember the specific terminology, but...
The third section.
The third boss... that you come up against has a potential to ruin runs. There isn't necessarily a way that I'm aware of to see what boss you're going to get for that tower, that section, before that section. So the earliest you can be forewarned about that boss is getting into section 3. And by that point, your deck is quite like formed. The goal of your each combat is already quite set out by that point.
So your last sort of set of dungeon runs is less, I need to make my deck better. It's often, I need to make my deck able to deal with this boss, because some of the bosses can be very specific in what they counter. So you and I succeeded in a run that you helped me with a little while ago, where we played a poison build with the Silent, which works about how you would expect poison to work, damage over time. But it used a lot of power cards. Powers? Yes, powers. And the boss had an ability where if you use power cards, they would become stronger. So a core part of our deck was really hardly countered by this boss. Like, we could not really do what our deck was built around doing if we did it to the full ball. We managed to find a way to make it work. We managed to get a few, like, good, got a lot of lucky draws, honestly, too.
And we left a lot of power cards in the deck, and they effectively become dead cards. If you're familiar with the economy of deck builders, that's really bad. You don't want dead cards in your deck because they make it so that you get to your good cards less often. So what was previously not necessarily core to our strategy, because otherwise we wouldn't have been able to do it, but important.
It definitely made it a lot harder.
Yeah, to our strategy, not only wasn't usable, it became a detriment.
But luckily we were able to do it, but it was more out of luck than it was necessarily about raw skill at that point. So this was, you know, a fairly hard counter. If you didn't know all the bosses in advance, like you did, we would have had a very different time. I would have continued on just making my build more of my build, as opposed to getting a few things to diversify it. And I would have gotten to that boss and just evaporated pretty instantly.
It is, I suspect, a bit of an overcorrection. But
yeah, I'd agree. This is the Smash system, but taken to the nth degree, almost. Not even the Smash system, it's very different entirely. I don't know why I make the comparison.
But having said that, these are not impossible bosses. Especially if you meet them with the right character. So, the boss that we fought that gets stronger with more powers, I don't remember the name of it, is a worse boss to meet if you end up playing the Defect, where one of the kits that the Defect can build is to invest in powers, where you spend a few turns early on setting up, and then you become really, really strong and powerful because you spent some bad turns. That is just not an option against this boss. When you set up, you set the boss up, and the boss is still attacking you. The Silent gets hard countered by another boss, in my opinion, which is the Time Eater, I think is the name of it. Every time you play 12 cards, like, you know, 12 hours in a day, it just takes the turn away from you, gets stronger, hits you. Even with our build, which was poison-based, it's not designed for lots of cards to be played necessarily. Like, but we did play a lot of cards per turn. That's just a natural consequence of playing the Silent. It's one of the things that the Silent does. So, yeah, definitely a very harsh, like, oh, you want to do this? Okay, cool. This boss is gonna get stronger every time you do some of that. It's gonna just stop you dead in your tracks when you try to go for this. There's some counterplay around it, and it's not impossible, but I think I've still failed to beat a boss that I considered a counter to my character at this point.
Okay, so you haven't managed to quite do it for everything yet.
So, for example, if I come up against Time Eater as Silent, I don't think I've ever had a build that could overcome it. If I come up against the Power Boss as a Defect, I don't think I've ever been able to beat it with a Defect. So I beat them with other characters.
This is very much overstepping what this sort of thing is going for, because it is sensible in the game to have bosses that are less susceptible to certain tactics than others. That is sensible and fair, and with a rogue like you're playing it many times, so it can be expected that you will develop knowledge over many plays to work out how this boss works and how to deal with it. But the issue here is, like, how harshly you get countered by it and how much the game rewards you for really having a refined build. Because the other thing in deck builders is a very thin deck that does only a few things is much better than a big deck. Like, this is an inherent thing to deck builders, is they encourage you to have one thing that you do really well, and these bosses go against that sort of core deck building ethos almost, and you've only got a small amount of time to correct your deck to suit them.
Yeah, when you are adjusting your deck one card at a time, it's quite punishing.
In the second tier of the dungeon, or spire, or whatever we call it, do you think there are similar sort of hard counts, or is only the third one that is like actually kind of...
I don't think the second one necessarily hard counters things. There are a couple of bosses that do very interesting things. So, for example, if you rely on debuffs, there is the possibility of running across the knight. When the knight gets down to half of its health, it just cleanses itself. So any built-up poison you might have had, for example, would go away. But like, that's not as punishing as, you know, every time you play 12 cards, you just make the
buff stronger. You need to restart your counter, but that's pretty manageable. And that's probably more so the fight doesn't become a cakewalk as opposed to... it being like a hard counter per se.
I do think that the bosses are likely designed thematically first and then mechanically second, because the game's pretty well built that way in my... so hard to say without speaking to the developers and getting their insights. But
yep.
The knight is...
it feels like...
yeah. It feels like what the knight does is goes, all right, you got me down to this point. Now come on, and then just like, you know, gets rid of all the debuffs and now he's serious. And with, I think the power eating boss is the awakened, you know, it's literally, yeah, the more you use the power, the more you wake him up and make him stronger, stuff like that. Time eater, very obviously, the more time you take, the more he gets stronger. So there's a theming going on that also happens to play into the mechanics. I don't know, it's really cool, though. I do still recommend anyone who has the opportunity to check out Slay the Spire. Its loop is really fun and cool and interesting.
Yeah, it's a super great game for sure. And like, we are talking about like an over example of this sort of thing, but even with that, it still stands up very strongly.
And keep in mind, right, this is the last boss. This is supposed to be hard.
Yeah, like, you know, a roguelike's default state is failure.
Yeah, that's right.
And so the success should be rarer, and so it's maybe not the most fun thing to like die at the end of a hard boss, but then it encourages you in your future playthroughs, like, keep in mind you shouldn't devote 100% into one tactic. You need to devote like maybe 90%, so in that final run you can diversify if you need to.
I think that basically covers it.
And so our next game saves the hard counters for optional content.
Bravely Default is a 2012 3DS RPG developed by Silicon Studio, directed and designed by Kensuke Nakahara, produced by Tomoya Asano. It originally started life as a sequel to Final Fantasy IV, The Heroes of Light, which itself was a callback to early Final Fantasy and the job systems in that game.
So, as a sort of historical note, Final Fantasy V's developers have talked about in some interviews that they're aware that Final Fantasy III, the first with a job system in the Final Fantasy series, was too hard. So, FF5 was the first Final Fantasy game to provide optional super bosses well beyond the power level required to beat the game. And while grinding would alleviate their difficulty somewhat, in order to beat them, you really had to get to grips with the system and work out how to defeat them. And this is sort of the origin of a lot of Final Fantasy super bosses, where the only things that really push you super hard to engage with the systems are these optional bits of content, because putting them in the mainline content would maybe make the game too difficult for a series that ultimately had aspirations to be fairly mainstream, which nowadays it is. But I think it's interesting that this sort of structure was put in really early, and Bravely Default is a really good example of this kind of system.
Let me paint you a picture / story. I was going to say let me paint you a story, and I realized that's a weird phrase, but...
a picture is 1,000 words, so you can paint me a story.
Okay, let me paint you a story. I was going through this game and I had a lot of free time at some point, so I was grinding a lot in this game. And I got to the point where I was max leveled, unlocked every job for every character at max level, and then realized that I have a lot more of this game to get through than I initially thought. I went to Bravely Default completely blind. I didn't know what its story structure was like, and so I assumed I was coming up on endgame, and I didn't really have the mind space to push through it, so I just sat around and grinded for a lot of it. What this meant is that I was way overleveled for a lot of encounters. And when you're way over level for a lot of encounters, two things happen. Your random encounters become, I'm just going to push attack and kill everything.
Which, to be somewhat fair, is a lot of Bravely Default anyway.
Yes, that is not necessarily something that comes from me. That's just, yeah, the game will let you trivialize normal encounters. And so you only start looking at boss fights. And with boss fights, I had found, oh, this strategy is good and takes a couple of turns, but I'll kill them, keeping myself fairly safe. I see the challenge. They're still bosses. They still take a couple of hits to take down, but no, this is pretty easy and safe. And then I got to Chapter 8, which is the actual end game of the entire game. And then I ran across a boss, well, a series of bosses put together in one fight as a boss formation, I guess, that annihilated me. I did the thing that I would normally do, and I think I died in two turns because they're capable of so much damage. They are capable of quad 9 damage if you aren't careful. And it made me take a pause and go, oh, wow, I am as maxed out as I can be in terms of levels and abilities. So this isn't a problem of I'm not up to the level requirement. This is a problem of I need to think about what tools I have a lot better. That's a really cool moment.
It is. And Bravely Default, for the most part, is very happy, and if anything, encourages you to fall into a strategy. Because to give a little bit more explanation of how its systems work, characters can have, you have four characters, they have their own base level, and then they can change into jobs. There are about 20 jobs, I think, in the game or so. Probably a different number, but like a number of jobs. And each job has its own job level that increases as you play it, and that gives you access to more abilities within the job that you can equip to other classes potentially, or other jobs. So this inherently has a level of encouraging you into dominant strategies because there's a certain level of investment required to get anything up to a certain point. You obviously transcended sunk cost fallacies by just investing into everything, which is not exactly typical play, but players tend to have this going on for a lot of the game, that they will have picked out their characters and classes and more or less building like each character into two or three classes for most of the game. And for the most part, the game's happy to go, yeah, you found a cool thing that's kind of broken, have fun with it, until it doesn't. And there are a few in-scenario encounters, like the one you mentioned, that ask you to do things that are a little bit more strict, like, you know, this battle required some defensive buffs that the game doesn't often ask you to bother with. It's a very offensive-focused game, like offense, and then occasionally heal to stop yourself from fully dying. But in that context, yeah, you need that specific strategy. And in a lot of the optional battles, through like the Nemesis and some of the class refights and things like that, they often require you to really dabble with a lot of systems. Like, you know, oh, this battle has really, really high elemental attacks. I need the Spiritualist class, which gives you a lot of like very strong elemental resistance buffs. You've got other things where you like you need really high DPS checks or like basically super hard counters against physical damage, but all require really specific job setups. Not like you need these four jobs and these X abilities, but you need like a much more strict compared to how the game usually plays, which is very freeform.
It almost becomes like a puzzle game.
Yeah, it becomes a really fun puzzle game with a really broad solution space.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. It's really great because a lot of RPGs, you get the feeling that, oh, if I was just stronger, if I just grind it out, this would be doable or easier. But the concept of super bosses are really cool because, no, it's not about that. It's not about your level. It's not about what abilities you have or don't have. They're designed with the assumption that the player has access to anything that the game is able to do, and then challenging them and going, all right, this is what you need to beat. What can you do?
And definitely levels help, but they're more increasing the margin of error rather than making it that much easier. One of the cool things that Bravely Default does to mitigate some of the problems with this is, as you get later in the game, the amount of job points you get is exponentially higher than it was before. So training up a class to max level is very easy. One of the cool alternate solutions it has, though, is a system called Ability Links. Bravely Default has a lot of like social systems in it that are quite interesting. They often get fairly ignored, especially because now the game has not much of a player base. You don't often have players who have friends who are playing it, who have characters to borrow. But basically, if you've got a friend who has uploaded their data into the cloud for Bravely Default, that is a friend on your 3DS friend list, you can borrow one of their characters, basically, and equip their job levels to one of your characters. So if I added your friend code on my 3DS, I could use the fact that you've maxed out every single thing in the game.
Yeah. Yep.
I won't have your stats, but I'll have your job skills. And that means that with a group of friends, ideally, you would have maybe not access to everything, but access to a lot of different things, more than you would usually, which helps you diversify a little bit and helps you really like find like the areas you could improve in and that you could delve into without needing as ridiculous a grind. You're still going to have to engage with the job system and get them up to level to do a lot of the things you need to, but you have like a bit more guidance into that, I guess, through the system, or you can skip it to some extent.
The ability links also, if you do this in tandem with a friend, it encourages people to talk about why a character is set up a certain way.
That's a really good point that I should have thought about. Yeah, it makes the whole process of working out a boss's strategy a really social experience. You know, it brings back that playground talk kind of thing, which games really struggle with.
Early on, I used a lot of ability links and just from randoms. I think you can pull different kind of data down from a random that's not on your friend list, or it's like that's less right. consistent. You can't do it every time or whatever.
So every day you can ask for some random friends, basically. And often what you get is not terribly powerful ability links. Like generally things are going to be better if you have friends who have played through, but they do exist, and the game gives you a few AI ones that have like a very limited amount of extras.
And genuinely, early game, they actually cheesed out some bosses for me, which is where that expectation was set up of, oh, this game is going to be easy, and then it just wasn't.
And Bradley Default is trying to be very friendly. Like, that's why a lot of these systems exist. Like, you can change encounter rates, you can very easily turn on or off experience and things if you want more challenge, you can change difficulty at any point. Like,
one of the abilities you get at some point is if the monster level you encounter is 20 below you, you auto win. Like, you don't even go into the fight, you just win.
Which is really satisfying as a thing to do.
It's how I grinded. Like, it's how I grinded.
So the game has some fairly hard counters in optional content with a few like wallish moments in the main campaign that are like, you need to at least somewhat understand the system before you progress.
It really wants you to enjoy your dominant strategy because it gives you so much to play with. And if you're not familiar with the Bravely Default system, you can go into debt to perform more actions, which is really satisfying for just alpha striking someone.
Bravely Default, like a lot of games, is a power fantasy, but Bravely Default, more than many other customizable games that I've run into, really leans into that power fantasy more. Like, it wants you to find absolutely broken nonsense. And for the most part, the game lets you get away with whatever you like, provided you can find it. And then it's only in these super bosses that you really have to, like, really prove your mettle and go like, I know how to break this game over my knee.
Yeah.
And with that, we're going to move into more of dominant strategies as like tutorialization, I guess.
Command & Conquer Red Alert 3 is a 2008 RTS developed by EA Los Angeles, produced by Amir Ajami, and designed by Jason Torres. This is mostly a stand-in for a typical and decent RTS, wherein its single-player campaign will trickle feed and introduce you units one at a time, maybe a few per mission, and get you to know their strengths and weaknesses as it goes on. RTSs have a very general dominant strategy mitigation built in by the fact that every unit will probably have a weakness, and if you're playing against someone competent, they're probably going to know what that is. It's just whether or not you can react fast enough.
And so for me, as someone who doesn't really play RTSs, so I don't have a lot of good internal logic for these, I played through the first 4 or 5 missions of Red Alert 3, and, you know, I didn't do super well with them, to be perfectly frank. But definitely I had, like, you get given a unit, and you get to see them really blitz. So you're like, this unit is good. And that's a really important thing to lay in a player's mind when introducing them to new content in a complex system.
What is their strengths?
Well, it's not just that what is their strengths, but it's more you need a player to agree with the game that the thing is good and worth using.
Oh, that's true.
Because it's very easy to like go, oh, this unit is strong against X, but then the game never like makes you believe that you need to worry about that. This is something like some games are better at than others. Anyway, the game's very good at throwing you a unit, showing you that it's brilliant. And then later, it shows you like the counter for it that you now have to think of some other way to do something with. And usually in the first few missions, gives you a new unit that can deal with the problem that you just ran into, shows you that it's good. So it's not just that you have the spider robots, which are good at everything, and the world bears that are not good. It's that you have the spider butts and the war bears that are both doing different things and good in different situations. And the game is super explicit about these are all very good, but not all the time.
So if you've never played a single player RTS campaign before, this isn't a lot of base building in the early levels. That's not what the game is about. The game is very much about the units.
Yeah, it's that drip feed of units with like a little bit of bases every now and then to like, okay, build some of these things, but it's like two options at a time or something. It's very, very minimal what you can do, which is fine because like the campaign in RTSs is generally considered a very large tutorial for the multiplayer segments because these games are big, complex beasts that are really hard to just make a tutorial for.
And one of the reasons I specifically pushed for Red Alert 3 to be the name that we talk about
is because it has Tim Curry in it.
Well, it's because it has Tim Curry in it. It's a great reason. If you are going to play a long, drawn-out tutorial, Red Alert 3's single-player campaign tries to make it as entertaining as possible. It's great. There's so much great acting from big names, in my opinion, who put their all into this game.
But what was your actual reason, aside from my interjection?
The entertainment of the actors. It's so fun to see George Takei be disapproving Shogun at you.
But, like, while we joke about that as well, like, it is a really good aspect of it. It is also worth noting, like, in the campaign, characters often come in to, like, tell you things you can do. And given that the storytelling is good is questionable, but, like, it's in super engaging, those cutscenes, you really pay attention to what anyone in that game tells you. And that is really hard to do, I think, in a game like this, to get players to pay attention to characters speaking at them. And that really helps the tutorial-ish side of this work. Like, when Natasha is talking to me, and the fact that I can even remember her name is impressive for an RTS-style story, like, I listen and go like, oh yes, I will actually do this. Anyway, so the game presents you with lots of situations that have sort of clear outs that lead you to take fairly dominant strategies that, like, you will lean to, and then hard countering them to get you to go into something else. Basic structure, because if you just threw players at skirmish maps, I reckon, they would more or less just go, oh, I want to do this, so they do that, and they don't really expand out.
Yeah, it sort of breaks down towards endgame units, because they're endgame units. Like, there is a world where I'm going to rush prism tanks and mass prism tanks. And depending on who you're playing against, that will work, because they have a lot of range, they have a lot of damage. It's going to be a bit hard to get in on them.
But ultimately, like, these tanks have a counter, right?
Of course, these tanks have a counter.
So the game has spent a long time teaching you, like, everything has a hard counter, which means that if you are playing and you feel like you're stuck, like, oh, I can't beat that, the game has sort of built you up going, like, you know, there's something that must do this.
Yeah, prison tanks can't hit air. Like, just bomb them.
I think that's... So it uses dominant strategies as a way of tutorializing the game to really make sure that you understand there are hard counters in this game between units. And with that, I think we're going to hard counter our discussion with the wrap-up. We started with Warning Forever, where the game adapts to how you play it constantly to prevent you from getting too consistent with one particular approach, forcing you to change styles a little bit. Then we moved on to Super Smash Bros. Ultimate with its spirit system, where you don't have to change your tactics necessarily, but the game is pushing you towards adapting your build per each encounter. But you can also opt out of it if you don't want to do it, or you can ignore it for the sake of a challenge deliberately.
And then we talked about Slay the Spire, where the arguably final boss of the Spire has a chance to just be someone that can completely obliterate the character that you're playing. From there, we talked about Bravely Default, where you can break the game early. You're likely to break the game early, and then you'll hit a point in the story where the game will just ask you to break it harder. It wants you to fully understand the systems, to be able to puzzle out the most broken thing you can throw at it. And lastly, we talked about Red Alert 3, which is very typical in the form of RTSs, where there are a lot of things that beat each other, and the campaign goes through it and shows you where something is good, and then what beats it, and what beats that, and what beats that, and just keeps building on that until it gives you effectively tutorial on all of the aspects of the game.
So this is the last in the main episodes of our Dominant Strategy series. However, next month, we're going to look at some games that sort of cover what we've talked about over the last five episodes in a wrap-up thing. We're also going to do an addendum episode shortly to answer some questions, talk back on some topics that we think are interesting. If you have any questions, please email them us to our email, which will be in the show notes, or send a message to us via social media, all in the show notes. Next month, we're going to be talking about Final Fantasy VIII, Final Fantasy VIII, and Final Fantasy VIII, along with two other games. Please send us a message on Twitter if you can figure out what the remaining two games might be. And with that,
thank you for listening.